This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by TrekFan. TrekFan isn't just a Star Trek fan club, it's a challenge. You will explore new places, learn new things, and collaborate with other fans to solve puzzles, complete real-life mission objectives, and win great prizes. And in the spirit of an enlightened future, TrekFan is absolutely free. Not just free to play, but completely free. Find out more by visiting fm.trekfan.org.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and as Matthew is still away this week, he is with Sloan on that secret Section 31 mission. I have a guest sitting in with me once again, but this week it's not Daniel Handlin. It is, in fact, Larry Nemechek. Larry, thanks for joining me.
It is the Christopher.
It is the Christopher. We are the Christopher.
We are the Christopher, yeah. Hi, Chris. I was just trying to think, have I been on the Orb before?
I believe you have. I think so. I have to check because you're getting close to getting that t-shirt. And as I was telling someone the other day, after you were onto The Journey with Char, I've got to create a new show because you keep getting closer and closer to being on all of them, and then I have to send you a t-shirt.
Oh, okay.
So I'm trying to stay a step ahead of you there, Larry. So here you are again on The Orb. And today, I thought we would do something similar to what you did onto The Journey and talk about the casting of Deep Space Nine, because it's always interesting to find out how certain actors were selected, but also how those actors influenced the characters, the characterizations that were envisioned before.
Right.
And then
right.
After they were cast, because that changes up a little bit as well. Now, unlike Voyager, where you were there the whole time, DS9, you weren't actually around the set when it was being created, were you?
No, it was, I mean, in pieces. So it debuted in January 93. So they were developing in 91, 92. They filmed the pilot in, actually I pulled my call sheets for the pilot, but they were filming that in late August into September of 92. So they'd cast it right before that. And, I think 92, I was like in my 1 week that I was out in March to work on the Next Generation Companions. So that was my first time in. So now of course everybody was very full of all the secrecy, you know, and people walking on eggshells and everything. And all this, you know, the secrecy was around, and oh, there's the new show, DS9. So it was still in that mode. So I didn't see anything. I was like Schultz on Hogan's Heroes. I knew nothing, saw nothing, knew nothing until the next year.
Right. But then as the series went along, you find out more and more about what's going on, and the series evolves.
Oh, right. Well, the first time I ever met Ira was the second year I was out, and I was starting to do cleanup, and I wanted to talk to him because he'd been a writer on Next Generation, the storied third season, and you know the people came in to help Michael out, and then so many people felt like they got burned, and I think he felt like it had been a crazy year for him. And then Michael, you know, famously talked him into coming back to help DS9 get started, and then there probably was a deal between them. Says, when I leave the show, you can be showrunner if everything works out. So, although aside from that wasn't the primary bait for him. It was like, no, it won't be like your next-gen experience. This will be cool and out of the box, and you can have people fight with each other because it'll be an alien crossroads, Casablanca, and all that. But the first time I met Ira, he was working on DS9, and same thing with Peter Allen Thiels. But I talked to him about their next-gen contributions, even as they were really sitting there working on DS9 at the time. So yeah, the next visit I was out, it was very much up and going and had aired and was very much there. And it was kind of weird because I remember thinking, oh no, if I'm going to write a book about DS9, I need to back up and get on top of things here already, you know, and it didn't round up going that way. But it was very weird because DS9 started off as the hot new show. And like Marina has talked about this, feeling like they were, you know, what are we, chopped liver here? Because they were losing out, they even thought on budget and everything.
Right.
Like sixth season into seventh season. But then almost as quickly, DS9 felt like the stepchild because Voyager followed right in behind Next Gen on the same stages. But Voyager got all the hoopla of being a network show.
Right.
And all of a sudden, DS9 felt like the middle child. So,
well, I remember when Voyager was being created. Well, I remember when all these were being created. But I remember with Voyager specifically, that feeling being there. And I really think maybe the TNG cast feels like they got, you know, lost some attention and budget in that way. But DS9 very much almost felt like it just got completely lost.
Oh, yeah.
There,
well,
the
don't cry for me, Argentina or Next Generation, because the first wave of being the second kid hit Next Gen. But, you know, they within a year, they knew that they were getting ready to do a movie and would have a movie franchise. So don't cry for them too much. And they
absolutely
had so, no, it didn't last near as long. It was just kind of that initial, oh, we're not going to be the cool kids on the playground, you know, quite as all to ourselves anymore. But again, they had a movie coming and nobody else ever got that. So
that's right. Well, when we talk about characters, the character I want to start with actually is from The Next Generation, and that's Miles O'Brien, because we can't really talk about casting Miles O'Brien since he was already cast and came over from TNG. But what about the decision to bring him over from TNG to DS9?
Yeah, well, a lot of this is rooted in you're going to have a spinoff of a successful show. So you want to give the spinoff all the great send-offs that you can. You want to bring the existing audience over. You want to make sure they find a comfortable chair in this new house for the audience to sit in, you know, to see what's going on. So, O'Brien was a very calculated – I say calculated. I don't mean in a sneaky way. It was a calculated move to give some familiar faces. It's the same way of shooting all the pilots. The pilots, even the Next Generation pilot, had DeForest Kelly in it. We've talked about this before, I think. The DS9 pilot had Patrick Stewart as Picard in it. So even just watching a pilot, you get a familiar character or two or situation
to
launch you. And Quark wound up in Voyager, and then Zephyr and Cochrane, although it was much more minor, it was a much more subtle touch, was there to kind of give a since they obviously were in different time periods, and they could have somebody.
So they're in Broken Bow you're talking about, right?
Yeah. But long term, you have a character in the cast, like, you know, and Miles O'Brien was a recurring character that got built up, and they liked Bob Justman liked Colm Meaney from the beginning, which is why he was in the pilot. He was Battlebridge Khan, you know. And they liked him and had him keep coming back and keep coming back.
Well, you know, the thing about bringing him over is that he is one of my favorite actors because when Colm Meaney acts, it's like he's not even acting. He's just so natural. And his role on TNG was very much just this background for most of the time. And then he became transporter chief, but really he wasn't the centerpiece of many stories. There was his wedding with Keiko.
Well, right.
But to bring him over to DS9, I mean, the character just blossomed so much on this show.
Right. Well, now, there's a couple things. He did get a couple of great shows on Next Generation, which wound up being great backstory for this one.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of them. The first one, really, and I don't know, maybe we should give a name to this phenomenon, but maybe we could call it the one name at a time situation, because it's like, you know, he starts off being Battlebridge Khan, and he's wearing red on Next Gen. Yeah. He's wearing command. And then the next, and you see him actually running around in a command shirt, running after the one of the alien ambassadors in Lonely Among Us, and then he's gone away. And that may be in because of Colomini himself really liked doing movies.
Yeah.
Indie movies especially. I'm sure he'd take big money for a bigger movie. But he really liked going back to England and going back to Ireland and being in small the Commitments, those movies about the Irish rock band, and he was the father of one of the members.
Mm-hmm.
That was like a trilogy of movies, and he always insisted on going back to work on those. But I, you know, he wasn't married to making his career in Star Trek. In fact, that may have been why he was so good at this, because he wasn't all hung up on being a success. He was always a take it or leave it guy. He could walk away if he needed to, but they would have him in, and they liked him for the. He had that blue collar, roll up your sleeves kind of hands on guy that seemed a little bit of a counterpoint to, you know, the perfect. People, humans, next-gen cast.
Right.
And that's what's – but the funniest thing is you can tell that they liked him and that he kept working out, because first he was nothing and he was just Battlebridge Con or security guard. And then they finally got – his popularity, small as it was, got ahead of the reality because they wanted to call him something in a transporter scene, because he was becoming, you know, familiar to people, to the crew and cast and viewers too. And Riker finally called him, you know, Lieutenant – because that's what he was wearing, which started the whole thing about the whole deal of rank and braid and are you a chief? Yeah. And what the hell are you? Started there before, but he had to call him Lieutenant because that's what the costuming had put on his collar, because they didn't know what he was. And they just went, okay, well, transporter chiefs, they tend to be low-level, you know, guys, low-ranking guys. And but he'd been in a few shows, we'll make him Lieutenant. So they wrote in there. And then he gets then he's O'Brien a few shows later, one name. And then finally he becomes Miles. You know, it's like one name at a time. And that's a true success story.
And then he becomes Miles Edward O'Brien.
And then Miles Edward O'Brien. So so O'Brien is a one name at a time guy, but everybody realizes what a great actor Colomini is, obviously. Yeah. And they're giving him better and better bits. And finally, you know, the role can't be contained by Transporter Room 3 anymore.
Right.
And he gets a role like O'Brien in The Wounded, where the whole backstory of the Rutledge and Setlick 3 and the massacre and Cardassians. And The Wounded is the show that debuts the Cardassians for the first time, even though they're in a slightly different, rougher form visually with their makeup and their costumes. And
a little
everything.
Bit bonier.
Bonier, right, and the costumes are
look.
Well, and the costumes look like they took like a gallon milk jugs and painted them brown and stuck them over, you know, whatever, kind of stomped on them. But that whole wonderful backstory and, you know, calling them Cardies and Spoonheads and all that.
Yeah.
And once again, here's a guy who's rough, really rough around the edges. He's noble, but he's got that blue collar, up from the, you know, bootstraps kind of feeling. We got so few instances where we actually felt bloodied on Next Generation, you know, unlike DS9 and even on Voyager and Enterprise. TNG was such the show. Part of it was like, oh, we don't have the budget to get you bloody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't have the budget to get the ship messed up. But Colomini and O'Brien, they kept giving him that there was just something about it that drew the writers to that. And you really got that when he tells the backstory of what happened on on Setlick 3. But that final scene in The Wounded, when he and Captain Maxwell, Bob Gunton, are in the ready room, in his ready room, and they do that camera pan around, and they're singing The Minstrel Boy, and it's like, wow, that was really a great one. That's one of the things to me that cemented O'Brien as somebody far beyond a guy that stands behind the console, guy transporter chief. And then of course, by the time they decide to have him be the one that got married, when they wanted somebody married on the ship in Data's Day, and they created Keiko for that episode, and of course she winds up coming over to Deer's Night with him. So there's two or three of those shows that they're really building him up, and even in other shows where it's otherwise, it's almost like the now you're so good and we know you have a movie career, we're embarrassed to only have two scenes for you in the show, so we're going to give you a pet spider in one of them, and we're going to give you way more touches than anybody else in the same number of lines would get in the show. So all of those were ways that people really felt like O'Brien was, you know, they really knew him. And of course they did. It just came in such small incremental increments.
Mm-hmm.
There's a phrase for you that it was really laying it. You didn't meet him in the pilot, bang, all of a sudden. You know, you'd really had laid that in over the years. And it wasn't the exact plan at Farpoint time, but like so many other things, there you go.
But I love looking at him sitting at the console in Encounter at Farpoint. and then watching him in What You Leave Behind when he finds Travis, the little figure that he thought that Julian had lost, and he holds it up and he's looking at it. And to think that he came from the pilot episode of TNG to the finale of DS9, mm-hmm. this one character is incredible.
Yeah. Way before, again, one name at a time.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the new characters on DS9 then, and start with the captain, with Captain Sisko. I personally can't imagine anyone else playing this role, which I guess is easy in hindsight when you get accustomed to someone, but especially throughout the Dominion War and what Captain Sisko had to do, and then the personality and the eccentricity of Avery Brooks, I can't imagine anyone else playing that part. What can you tell us about the casting of Avery Brooks and the character beforehand, and then how the character evolved?
Well, how about this? I think he was pretty much an odds-on favorite early on for that. Of course, Avery Brooks' claim to fame before this had been playing a character named Hawk on Spencer for Hire.
Who looked a lot more like the Sisko that we got from season four onward, right?
Well, there's a whole path about, I think Avery Brooks, you know, an actor likes to be a rubber mask. He likes to be, to think that you could be molded and shaped into anything. But I think if truth be told, Avery enjoyed something about having the goatee and the rougher edge. And I think one of the reasons why, I mean, you know, as actors, as anything we do, we like to be, malleable. We like to be versatile. But we can't help but having things that are more in our groove than other things. And I think he felt really really in the groove for this, even though he didn't. And over time, even though they had him without the goatee, of course, they don't want anybody to think Hawk when they see Ben Sisko. Right. So it's all those paranoias out of the gate of having a pilot, you know, on a new show. Well, the good thing is we're going to have this known person as this actor, but then we want it to be a little bit, you know, we can't have it just be confused with the role you had over here. So, no, let's have you... let's have you all clean shaven and still get to be brooding. I mean, my God, they've, you know, written the part to be brooding. Of course, everything about DS9 was meant to be a pendulum swing away from all the things that had made Next Gen popular. You know, it's that old, you got to be the same but different,
right,
mantra, you know. So, I mean, they interviewed a lot. What's interesting to me about DS9 is I know you see all the pilots for all the series, actors who are runners-up. They're very fresh in the casting people's minds, and they get used. And some of the ones from Next Generation are probably the most famous of all.
Like Billy Campbell for Riker playing
Tim Russ for Geordi, you know, and wound up coming back.
He was in Starship Line, yeah.
Right. And to tell you the truth, I'm not as familiar. I haven't come across the paperwork. I haven't seen research on – I know they're out there. And I think some have popped up, but we really don't talk a lot about. It was just as it was the intention to have Catherine Janeway, although you have to kind of have it in the name, the way we do things on Earth, to have that be the first woman captain. There was a big push on to have this, unless just the casting fell apart. There was a push on to have this be the first African American, you know, Star Trek lead captain.
Right.
So they were going that direction with the casting. But not really a lot about runners-up like we have with some of the other shows. They're obviously out there, but not. But once they decided on Avery, there was a big push to have him be very un-Hawk-like, which was then there was kind of a dynamic the first two or three years until, as we all know, he wound up in the goatee anyway. And
somehow the goatee finds you.
Yeah, it's kind of like Kate Mulgrew wound up with her wedge hair anyway. So... You know, it's like, guys, don't fight it.
I'm glad Janeway didn't end up with the goatee, though. I don't think that would have been a good look on her. Or Sisko with the bun of steel.
The bun. Well, they had their, we can get into this in a little bit, but they had their share of hair wackadoodles on DS9 too, so.
Yeah.
When we get to Dax, so.
Well, the next character is connected to Sisko, and people will probably think, why are you going to this character next? But I want to talk about this character next because of the connection with Benjamin Sisko, and that's Jake Sisko. Very difficult to cast a child in a role when you know a series is probably going to run 7 years, and Sirach Lofton went from being the little kid to being so tall and a man at the end of the show. But I'm glad he's on the show because the dynamic between Jake Sisko and his father, and also Siroc Lofton, Avery Brooks. I can't imagine that they could have predicted the chemistry between Avery Brooks and Siroc Lofton at the time of casting.
Oh, yeah. Well, one thing that isn't, I mean, I hate to keep saying that this is like the most boring origin story of casting of all the shows. That's not it at all, because of course it's, and there's a lot of twists and turns, and we'll talk about a lot of them, but I really think they settled, with the exception of maybe one character, they really got to who they liked. They either had a good idea out of the gate who they were kind of going toward, or they found someone fairly fast for all these. But one thing that's interesting that you can tell from like the iterations of the writer's guide as far as how a character evolved, maybe in terms of who got cast, is Jake Sisko was originally down as a recurring character. So,
which he kind of was something as the series went along, right?
Right. But from day one, he's out front. He's above the line. He's out front in the opening opening titles, mm-hmm, with the regular cast. And not that on DS9, that seemed to mean the least.
Right.
We had, you know, 50 recurring characters at one point, and half a dozen of them, you know, Garrick and Rom and everybody else might as well have been regulars in people's minds. They were.
Yeah.
But Jake, something about Siroc made them had faith that they could, just as a young kid, like you said, when he's little bitty Jake, that he could hold up and you know, he could just, of course, they still had the child labor laws of how many hours they could have him on set, just like they'd had with Will on Next Generation. But something about Siroc, he was enough of a performer they could lean on even as a child, and they felt like, you know, having him out in the mm-hmm, in the regular credits, which is, you know, to his credit.
How hard was it to find him? Do we know how many people they auditioned?
I haven't found anything. Again, not. Yeah. This is where I miss, you know, with Voyager and Enterprise, I was out while those castings were going on.
Yeah.
And having, for Next Gen, having Bob Justman's casting notebook is a wonderful little insight into history. And I personally haven't come across anything. I haven't seen over the years, like I said, DS9 seems to be the most, and maybe it wasn't that way, but the record that we have and what other people have had the chance to talk and write and research, we haven't had it. It's been more about the characters took a wacky evolutionary turn, and we haven't even talked about some of them yet. But
well, that's
as far
the thing,
as the casting
though.
Actors, yeah.
Well, that's the thing, though, about DS9 is it is sort of the mystery, and especially now that we have Enterprise Blu-rays, now we've learned all this stuff about Enterprise, but of course Enterprise was developed during the internet age anyway, so we learned a little bit more about it as it was going along. But DS9 seems to still be shrouded largely in mystery. If you go to Trek Corps, for example, and you look in their photo section and you look at the casting photos, behind the scenes photos, there's nothing. There are almost no high resolution images of anything related to DS9, but there are for TNG and for Voyager, and of course for Enterprise because it was in a digital camera age. Mm-hmm. But it's just such a mystery. I mean, the DS9 companion itself is fantastic, but outside of that, until we get DS9 Blu-rays and Ira and Ron and all these people come back and sit down and actually talk for hours on camera about this, mm-hmm, which I know that they're very anxious to do. It certainly seems that way. It feels like we're not going to uncover the kinds of details that we know about TNG and Voyager.
Right. And I don't want to seem mercenary, but there there hasn't been any money in it yet.
Yeah. So, but there will be. The fan base for DS9 is growing day by day.
Right. And that's something whenever I do my little polling at the beginning of my panels, especially the discussion forum or the state of the franchise forum that we do, whether or not there's a blogger quotee in the audience, mm-hmm, whenever we...
What are you talking about, Larry?
Oh, I don't know. But next time you hear the rumors about me starting and canceling series deals, they're all true. They're all true. We just haven't been to a place where we've had that. But DS9's comeback has been, you know, Iris said this back in the day that we were talking about how DS9 felt like it was the sandwich, it was the stepchild, it was the middle child of the series. You know, about the time they thought they should be taking center stage, they get kicked over the side by, mm-hmm, oh, it's the network show of Voyager. And Ira kind of bemoaned that at the time, but they, you know, they didn't let it get them down. They went on and did the show they wanted to do. And part of that may have been why we love it so much, because as much as Rick wants to say no, they really kind of existed in a vacuum a little bit as far as creative control.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's why the show is so good. I am convinced that's why the show is so good. If Voyager had not been created, if UPN had not been launched, I'm not sure that DS9 would have evolved into the great series that it became, because they really were sort of left to, you guys write what you want to write. And I think you can tell me, I always forget where it is. I think it's on one of the DVD extras where Ira says, when we brought Vic Fontaine on and the studio didn't say anything, we knew that we could just do whatever the hell we wanted to do on this show.
Right, right. Yeah. Forget that whole, you can't do a war show on Star Trek. Star Trek is about peace. I mean, that's what fans were fighting over. The writers knew the real battleground would be, can we do a Lounge Singer?
That's right.
And yeah. Yeah, and some of the, you know, some of the other things, that, but yeah, the middle child, and but now polling and surveying, just in an informal way. At least, again, this is the this is the faction of fandom that goes to conventions and shows up in my panel rooms. You always find people say, "No, DS9 was not what brought me to Star Trek," but there's always a big gap between that. You know, there's 100 people in a room, there's 200 people in a room, one or two people will say, yes, DS9 was initially what brought me to Star Trek.
Yeah.
But you go back the other direction, and 8 or 10 or 15 people out of that 100 or 200 will now say, it's my favorite show.
Yeah.
And maybe there's more than that, but the point is, it goes from 0 to 60.
Yeah.
You know, its legacy is catching up with it, and as Ira predicted, more people are finding it and appreciating it more. And it's almost like between serialized, you know, between the grimness or the shadows, I should say, maybe, and the whole, you know, it was pre-9/11, but post-9/11, all the themes about security versus individual liberty that, you know, Ron brought to brought to Battlestar Galactica, and just the old serialized, you know, the mini arcs on DS9, but the Dominion War arcs and all that versus the standalone shows that became the norm, you know, after Lost. All of that seems like it was way ahead of its time, and people are, if nothing else, they're more comfortable watching DS9 now than they were, I think, at the time.
Yeah, I think so too. Well, let's go on to a character where there is a little bit of people know a lot about it already, I guess, but there is some story behind it, and that's Kira, because originally, just like we brought Miles over, there was the thought that Ro Laren would be the first officer, but instead we get Nana Visitor as Kira.
Right. I was going to say, I almost wish we had twinned this up, because the initial, again, that initial idea of, gee, we're starting a new show, but let's give some touchstones to the audience to make them feel familiar. It wasn't just O'Brien, but it was going to be two characters from Next Gen, and we were going to have Ro Laren over. And especially, and again, she had a little bit later start than O'Brien, but she'd begun as a recurring character with a lot bigger splash to start off with, because she had an episode named for her.
Well, if
and Michelle Forbes, you know, made such an impact out of the gate too. They loved that casting.
If you think about her being considered for coming over to the show, her story on TNG feels more like she's being set up to make the move, whereas Miles just feels like he became a fan favorite, and so let's bring him over.
Right. Well, and I swear up, I mean, they swear up and down that at the time they made Ensign Ro, which was very early in that season, you know, toward, what, fifth season? At the time, because I asked them, I said, now, were you already having the roots of the whole Bajoran background? I mean, the Cardassians had been around for season four, were started. The Bajoran background of Ro, because, of course, they were called the Bajora then, which shows how noodly that was their initial bit, and some of the pieces are very, it's still an allegory on whether you want to say it's the Palestinians and Israelis, or it's any of the occupied countries in Europe, like during the war, kind of that feeling, because the Cardassians always seemed like Star Trek's Nazis to me, the fascists.
Well, in the short story Horn and Ivory, there's actually an explanation for the Bajora and why that pronunciation is there, what the name was.
Oh, okay. Do you want to share it with the audience, or?
Oh, it just has to go back. In that story, Kira gets thrown back in time. I think, I may be wrong, it's been a while since I read it. I think it's 10,000 years back. And it tells the story of the Bajora, and the Bajora were like a small group on Bajor, a religious sect who came to dominate the entire planet. And so when it became a global society, they became the Bajoran. They kind of unified behind that. But originally, they were just one of many, many. If you think about, like, you know, clans in the medieval Europe or something like that. And so that's why the planet became known as Bajor, because the Bajora were the clan that finally won out and united everyone.
Oh, okay. Kind of like the Zindi Bajora or something here.
Yeah. They were all in the...
No, I didn't say that. Right. Well, but, you know, if you look at it that way, basically, I know Rick and Michael and even Jerry, although she didn't do DS9, they all say, no, we did not have, let's come up with this right here, and a year after we introduce the Cardassians, we'll bring in the Bajora, make up this, you know, rich background tapestry, even just for one show, because we're really launching this one character. I mean, it was a lot of work just to finally have a recurring, you know, con person after Wesley left. Because they were kind of quasi-trying out people, like little characters, kind of like more O'Briens, only at the helm instead of, you know, at the transporter console.
Right.
And none of them really stuck. And I think instead of having these just, you know, and most of them tended to be female for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they liked the dynamic on the
Riker,
bridge.
Yeah. That was part of his requirements, I think, for bridge
that
officers.
That's right. Yeah. If you're sitting in front of me and wearing my color. Yeah.
Right.
Will. Just give it up and go back for Deanna. I think they decided, you know, rather than going through these vanilla, you know, female con officers of the week, let's really come up with a character and have it have some prickliness. Let's have it have some texture. And, you know, and that was part of the impetus for coming up with the story and the background. But they swear up and down at the time they were not doing this with even the greater thing in the back of their minds of, and when we do the spinoff show, this can be the background. This can start laying in the background. Because it is an awful lot of richness just for that one episode. But, I mean, part of that was to launch her, you know, and they didn't know whether that would take off and they would wind up adding her as a regular. And, again, Michelle Forbes is a lot like Colomini in that she's a young actor. Well, not young, but I mean, she's an up-and-coming actor who's really good. Everybody can tell that. They jump off the screen. I mean, anybody that started off playing like the daughter in one scene of the Next Generation show with about aging, and she's got the wacky hairdo, and you go from that to Ro Laren because of her that smoldering kind of intensity, not sexual, but just that intensity, and the backstory they make up for Bajorans, and especially her personal story on top of that, just fits it to a T. But Michelle Forbes is one who's working on a movie career. She's a young actress coming up and doesn't want to be tied down in a series television. So she was, you know, there for a while. She was happy to do recurring bits, and they wrote the character. And some people might even say that maybe they weakened it, or they smoothed the rough edges too fast.
Yeah.
But somewhere along the way, as they then, you know, within a year, they were developing the, you know, DS9 and thinking that and offered it to her, and she ultimately didn't want to come over.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, you know, Colum was really the same way. He was leery about taking the regular, I mean, he loved the paycheck, and he loved, you know, I think he enjoyed working for Rick and Michael and that crew, but he was really big on his movie career too. And there's times, you know, where we lose O'Brien in the first couple of seasons, especially because he was very insistent, and he apparently had the clout to say, yes, I'll be a regular, but I'm not going to be here for two or three episodes every season because I'm going to be doing a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, okay. You know,
well, enough stories to tell, you know, on the station to make that work. It's easier than on a starship where, like, well, where'd he go? You know, but when you're on a space station, maybe he is gone somewhere.
Right. There's a really funny little cartoon meme that's out for O'Brien. It's like meanwhile down in, it says, what does O'Brien do all day when he was on the D? It was just like, it's like a multi-panel thing where he's standing behind that transporter console, just kind of whistling, looking around the room, like panel, 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 panel. Then someone comes in, he beams them down, then he goes back to panel,
panel.
just sitting there kind of looking off to the side, whistling. Like, really? Do they have to stand there for 8 hours?
That's what you picture them doing, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, oh my God, the transporter. And then, which is funny, then at the end, because his goodbye scene, which was kind of cool. It's the kind of thing you can do when you've got side-by-side series shooting like that, is it was no big deal, no extra cost to have a scene of him on the Enterprise saying goodbye, you know, because you just walked across the street and went over to the next gen sets and did it. But his, like, uh, his homage goodbye to Transporter Room 3 was was kind of quirky, but yeah.
Well, it's a touching scene though with Picard. So yeah. So they didn't bring Ro over, so they have Kira instead, and they found Nana Visitor. She has become, for me, one of my favorite actresses, when I had no idea who she was, of course, before DS9. How did they discover her?
She was New York-based and just came to the top of the casting. From everything I can tell, she just rose to the top of the pile. She came from a dancer's background.
Mm.
Her parents were all New Yorkers and Broadway and stage. And I just got to see her at FedCon. She still looks amazing.
Yeah,
she's got the dancer's body.
Mm-hmm.
If you see pictures of her from stage. And not to be sexist, too sexist there after all the years of Kira boots and uniform controversies and all that. But it's also interesting to note that, when they start, this happened twice on DS9. But when you see her in the pilot, she's got the hair flip like Michelle Forbes had for Ro Laren. The little, I don't want to say Mary Tyler Moore hair, but that flip at the bottom. And when they're watching the pilot, somebody thankfully goes, that's really a little manicured to be, that's a little coiffed.
It didn't quite
fit
her personality.
To be a Bajoran freedom fighter. Right, yeah. Right. So let's clip it back.
Yeah. The thing about Nana Visitor's personality is so different from Kira's personality. Though I feel like when I hear her talk somewhere, it's such a, maybe she softens towards the end of the series a little bit, right? When she's with Odo,
right.
But early on, she's so the angry Bajoran, which I think a lot of people picture her as being all the time, even though she actually does evolve and soften a little bit. But it's the character feels very different than the person they cast for it.
Yeah. But I think that's, I just think that shows Nana's range. Again, she came from a, I don't want to say she came from a dance background like dancers can act. Musical theater, you have to do it all and be very versatile.
Mm-hmm.
And I always remember the first thing that Nana did after DS9 was over was she was in a production of Chicago and played Roxy, I think. But, the part that Renee Zellweger had in the movie. But yeah, no, she's got the chops, and she can still sling it. I mean, she can, and of course later on, we haven't talked about Bashir yet, but she and Sadig El Fadil, or Alexander Sadig, when he anglicized his stage name, wound up having a relationship and getting married and having a child together, and then went their own ways later on, but still are very, very fond of each other. They showed that on stage when they got together at this convention I was just at in Germany. Which is nice, but anyway, she's just a really with it, fantastic person.
Well, Bashir's the next person that I have on the list to talk about here, and like you said, they did become involved and become married, and it's fun as you watch the series, especially at the time when they're dating, before they get married, and they have scenes together to try to figure out, where are they in the stage in the relationship here, and does it come through on camera or not? But
right.
How did they cast Sadig El Fadil?
Well, here's one that we actually can back up and do a little bit of story on, because in the writer's guide, aside from bringing Ro Laren over, so that the first officer was originally going to be, that character that we all knew, and that was going to be a launching point. Dr. Bashir was actually Julian Bashir in the first draft all the way through was actually Julian Amoros, and was going to be some either Spanish or some Latin American background. And I do know that Sid first auditioned by tape from London, and they liked him. And you can tell they liked him because, pretty quickly they had him come out. And he was another case where I think he pretty much, after the first wave of auditions, he pretty much knocked it out of the park and they loved him. Kind of like Ethan Phillips and Bob Picardo on Voyager. I mean, there are some, and Roxanne and Tim. On Voyager, there are some actors come in and they go ahead and they always have to cover themselves, but with reading other people. But that was one where the minute he walked in, I think they pretty much gave it to him. So much so that obviously they had to change it, but by the time they issued the third writer's guide, kind of early on, they had already changed that to Bashir to match the Arabic background rather than Hispanic background. Which there's been times over the years when I'd see like my letter column or a Q&A kind of thing, and people and Hispanic fans who, you know, people get all identified with their culture and they like to see themselves in Star Trek, and saying, why aren't there any more, you know, like Hispanics in Star Trek? And I go, well, actually, mm-hmm. it was going to be a regular, but sorry, yeah. guys, it got, you know, this won't make you feel any better, but at least the intention was there. But they, you know, just the power of, and he is. That character was exactly the way he was supposed to be, green and unintentionally arrogant, you know, and he carries that off. And then they took him on the wild ride of, you know, pairing him up with Garak and pairing him up with O'Brien, and then the whole thing of being genetically engineered, which Sid still talks about how that took, that he hated that, like yeah. over 2/3 of the way through the show, and it felt like he'd had the rug pulled out from under him as a character, a little bit like the way Michael Dorn and Worf early on when they had the third season show where he won't give his blood to the Romulan, mm-hmm. and you know, initially Michael's saying, that's horrible, now I'm a bad guy, and they're like, no, you're Klingon and it's great texture, and they really have to be convinced, you know, they think it's how can you ruin my character like this, aren't you supposed to be responsible for the show? And that's the way, you know, Sid was about making, you know, feeling like 11th hour.
Yeah.
What do you mean genetically? Although it really is kind of a funny, funky way of explaining some of, you know, his smugness and his
Well, I like to go back and watch the first few seasons and look for the spots where you can say, oh, yeah, he's genetically enhanced. That's why he can pick this pattern out of a medical scan so quickly or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. completely retconning the writing, but it's kind of fun to... It fits together much better than you think it would for something that they just came up with last minute before an episode.
Yeah.
And even
coming up with something last minute before an episode, I don't know about you, but I just kind of, when it's like Ira and Ron and Renee, I just kind of intrinsically trust those guys. Not, I mean, there's little bits of, either it's a wholesale chunk of the show or it's a tiny little bit of canon that will make people kind of go, now we have to fix that. But in this case, I really think it fits. I almost think that either they or their assistants or somebody sat down and kind of did a real cursory look back. You know, like, no, wait, if we do this, are we really going to screw up something from Bashir? And to put that, you know, it's almost like it's a superhero, you know, it's almost like Batman or Superman running around doing what they do and then being exceedingly good at it at times. You know, like, oh, look, it's Clark, you ran off just when the building was on fire and all the people were saved and Superman showed up. But it's almost like he's so good at what he does. And there's a couple of, you know, like a little bit of that arrogance at the beginning that sets off Kira at the very beginning and sets off O'Brien mm-hmm. when they roll their eyes at him. It's almost like that helps explain that. Like, he's so young, he can't blend in and be unsuspicious. You know, all the time. He's going to set people off if they only knew that he was, you know, it's hard when you're that much better than everybody.
Right. Exactly.
It's hard to hide it, especially when you're 20 or 22 or 24 or 26.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it does fit.
So I'm going to cut in here for a minute, everyone, and just let you know that Larry and I talked for a really long time about DS9 casting and character creation and how the characters evolved into those we see on the series here. When Larry and I start talking, we tend to talk for a really long time, and be glad that you don't hear the unrecorded conversations that we have, because then we really, really do talk for a very long time when we get on Star Trek topics. So I'm going to do something unusual here and actually split this episode of The Orb into two separate episodes. And the reason is that I don't want to give you a 1 hour and 45 minute or 1 hour and 50 minute episode of The Orb to get through. I think it'll be easier to break it up here. So next week, I will continue with the second part of this conversation with Larry about the casting and the characters on Deep Space Nine. And then after that, Matthew should be back from his secret mission, and we'll be back to our normal routine here on The Orb with Matthew and me. And we're actually going to be getting very close. Well, we will be actually when Matthew's back. We're going to be back to the next part of our discussion of the final chapter. We'll be looking at the fifth part of the story, When It Rains. And I can't wait for that. It's going to be great to have Matthew back and really, really dig in to that amazing final 9-episode arc. But until then, and until I come back next week with the second part of my discussion with Larry, here's a look at some other things that we've been discussing here on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
I mean, it's been talked about, you know, by Shatner that he's like, oh, I wanted to have the Enterprise find God or something like that. Well, how does that work?
Right.
You know, and it's like, well, it doesn't work the way you're doing it in this movie.
Earl Grey.
What if it was like a geeky tween boy? Data, where are you? They're just like, shut that off.
Mr. Data, I've got a problem.
The Ready Room.
When they finally do get rid of Decker, it's on Kirk's personal authority as captain of the Enterprise. And, like, it seems to me if you're, say, a captain in the U.S. Navy and an admiral takes command of your ship, you can't just, like, get rid of him because of your personal authority as captain of the ship.
The Orb.
And again, it's something, as you know, as we said before, the system is not set up to allow him to express that idea in any other way. But by the spectacle of this trial, which would presumably be impossible to hide, it is a way for him to express this alternate viewpoint that maybe the morality of his society is under threat.
To the journey! We are here to talk to you about a very heavy-handed topic. This is kind of a dark area for us. No, I'm just kidding. We're talking about death in Voyager. Commentary, Trek Stars.
When they thaw out the pod people and they say, why, what year is it? And Data says, why, it's the Earth year 2364. I fell off my chair 47 times. It's like, they just put the... Oh, my, okay.
Warp 5.
Archer doesn't close himself off to any possibility. He takes the evidence and comes to the best choice that he can. And that's not always easy for anyone, but that's the kind of person that Degra is, too.
Melodic Treks.
Ephatic had two versions of the theme, one which ran from seasons 1 to 3, and one which ran from season 4 onwards. Now, some people prefer the first music with the poignancy of the lone trumpet, others prefer the second incarnation.
Continuing mission.
If we were to sort of able to rewrite the canon, the uniforms we've got, they were the uniforms in the middle of Enterprise and TOS, but because they were designed during a time when peace wasn't as prosperous as it is in the original series, the uniforms did have a bit more of a militaristic look to them.
Literary Treks.
You know what I love about comics, though, sometimes, is what happened here in this panel with Beverly and Troy. Clearly, Troy's stunt double wandered into the scene.
I was going to say, is that Troy?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find us pretty much anywhere you find your podcast, whether that's iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune, BlackBerry, Spreaker, Swill. We're on SoundCloud now also. And of course, you can go to the website and you can stream the episodes from our show pages. We have a SoundCloud player on there now as well, so it's even easier than ever to stream. And you can grab the RSS link and pop that into your favorite podcatcher application as well. We received a message the other day from listener Rajiv Varma in Michigan. And Rajiv, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name. I hope I have that right. And Rajiv wrote, "Hi guys, I just found out about your podcast series, and I have started listening to it from number 1. I have to say that the intro, outro music for each episode is the best podcast music I have ever heard." Well, Rajiv, thank you so much for that. I really appreciate that. It's several pieces of music from DS9 overlaid on top of each other to create that dissonance, which I think captures the spirit of DS9 very well. And of course, we have that great piano music there as well, which is called After 3 a.m. at Quarks. So we're really glad that you're enjoying that. And more importantly, we're glad that you found the show and that you've gone back to the very beginning. I hope you enjoy listening to our character episodes there at the beginning. If anyone's listening to the show, by the way, and you came in recently, go back to the very beginning and check that out. We went through every major character except for Ezri, I believe it was, early on. pretty much one after the other. And since then, of course, we have covered Ezri as well as some minor characters. Well, they're not minor in DS9, but people who don't have their names in the title screen as we're panning around the station. So thanks for listening. Glad you found us. Hope you enjoy the show. And be sure to write in again and let us know what you think as you're listening along. And the same goes for everyone else. We really want to hear your feedback about the show and share your feedback with everyone else who's listening. And there are a number of ways that you can send us feedback. You can go to our website at trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the orb, and that will come to us by email to Matthew and me both at the same time. You can also find us on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. You'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. You'll also find us on Google+, where we have a community. Just search G+ communities for Trek.fm and you'll find us. We also have forums on our website at Trek.fm/forums. And if you go to the show page for this episode on our website, in the left sidebar, you'll see a widget that lets you send us a voicemail using just your webcam's microphone, and you can upload that from the page. And we really would love to hear your voice and share that with everyone. So consider taking advantage of that. If you'd like to find me, my username on Twitter is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. If you'd like to find Matthew, his username is MattRushing02. And also, Matthew and I do another show together called Literary Treks, and that's all about Star Trek books and comics, and we interview authors on there. And I also do Warp 5, which is about Enterprise, Matterstream, which is an interview show about the world inspired by Star Trek. The Ready Room is a show I do every week with other hosts from around the network, including Matthew from time to time, and also including Larry pretty often. Larry comes on quite often with us there, and we talk about all 5 live-action Star Trek series there and Star Trek news. On Hyper Channel, I bring you some Star Trek news every single day, very short format, about 15 minutes long. And then Continuing Mission is a show where I interview the people who create Star Trek fan series. So check out all of these things and find out what we're talking about all around the network. Before I let you go, I would like to tell you about our sponsors for today's show. First, there's Audible.com. They are the best source for audiobooks that you'll find anywhere online. I've been getting my books from them for 14 years, so that should say something about how great their selection is. They have over 150,000 titles for you to choose from right now. And best of all, as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice just for trying Audible. All you need to do is to go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up. If at the end of the trial you decide not to stick with Audible, there's nothing to lose because you get to keep that book, but I know you're going to want to stick with them. And by supporting Audible, you are really helping us keep the orb coming to you every single week. The money that we receive from Audible when you try out the service almost covers the cost of hosting the orb for one entire month. So that's a huge help for us. Plus, you're going to get great audiobooks, great selection, great pricing at the same time. So just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm. Get that free audiobook today. Anything you want, just choose a book you like and find out how great Audible is. Again, audibletrial.com/trekfm. We really thank you for supporting them. And we thank Audible for supporting the show and the network. We'd also like to thank TrekFan. Now, TrekFan is not just an ordinary Star Trek fan club. It's an adventure. It's a place where you can take your love for Star Trek and use it to make the world a better place, you know, to chart new territory and to get involved with other fans. You'll actually collaborate with other fans and you'll solve real life missions. And they have many other things for you to do there as well. One thing that they have going right now is called Starfleet Academy. And the way Starfleet Academy works is you join TrekFan, and then they send you a random Star Trek novel, absolutely free. And then you read this novel, and when you're done, you don't send it back to them. You actually give it to a friend, and you let your friend read it. So you just keep passing this novel around because they're not a library. They're not expecting you to return this book. All they want you to do is to write a review of the book and send it back to them. They are compiling a database of book reviews to help Star Trek fans learn more about the Star Trek universe. And of course, this isn't the only thing they have going on there. They have many, many things for you to do there, and it's a great way for you to get in touch with other fans in your area. And best of all, it's absolutely free. So go find out what's going on at TrekFan. All you need to do to find out and to join is to go to fm.trekfan.org. That's fm.trekfan.org. That's a special URL that lets them know that you heard about it here on Trek FM and on The Orb. So please do use that URL, but go check it out. It's a wonderful idea. It's a great fan club, a great place for you to go and share your love for Star Trek. That's fm.trekfan.org, and we really thank them for their support of the show and the network. Well, thanks for listening today, everyone. Again, I'll be back next week with the second part of this discussion with Larry Nemechek. And then after that, Matthew will be back and we'll be jumping in to the next part of the final chapter. So join us again next week as we once again gaze into the orb.